You are listening to Spirit World Restless with DJ Judy on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at yahi.net, port 9000. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at http://spfradio.yahi.net for playlists, schedules, archives, and more. This first episode is devoted to a conversation with the poet Martina Newberry. Now, the first part of our chat. Enjoy. I'm speaking to Martina Newberry. Martina is a writer of poetry since childhood and has published many books, including After the Earthquake, Perhaps You Could Breathe for Me, An Apparent Approachable Light, Lima Beans and City Chicken, Hunger, Not Untrue and Not Unkind. Together with another poet, The Banyan and the Alder, and her newest books, What We Can't Forgive and Late Night Radio. Since coming across her work on the internet at globalpoets.org and her video clips on YouTube, I've become a fan and wanted to find out a little more about her as an artist and a vibrating woman who creates work that resonates with so many. So Martina, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me today.
It's wonderful to talk to you.
I'm so glad. How did you get started as a poet?
Oh, my goodness. I'm an only child, so I, you know, books and notebooks have been my friends forever. And I began writing at a really young age.
How old were you?
I was 4. And I started writing little stories, you know, and funny little, I was very, very taken with Robert Louis Stevenson's Child Garden of Verses, and I memorized those and loved them. And so I've been writing little things ever since I was a kid. I started actually writing poetry that I considered real poetry in college. I started taking myself a little more seriously, but I never really did anything with it until very, very much later. And I took a poetry class and was mentored by the instructor there. I sort of got a kickstart to my adult writing life by this poetry workshop I took from a wonderful, wonderful man named Larry Kramer. Larry Kramer only did 2 books in his life, and he was my mentor, my very dear friend, my brother. And he taught me ways of seeing and ways of perceiving that added to the way I wrote. He never taught me how to write. He simply discussed ways of looking at things, and I loved that. It was a way of tell me how you see it and then put that on paper. And we worked together for several years until he passed. He was a magnificent poet, just a wonderful poet. Named Larry Kramer, his book is called Brilliant Windows.
Well, you were fortunate to meet him.
Yes.
On the other side of things, what has been the worst thing that anyone has ever said to you about your poetry?
Grace Shulman, who is the leader of the, or was the facilitator of the New York Y. I went to Bennington to a writing workshop there, and I had her for one of the classes. And she told me that I'd probably be more comfortable writing greeting cards. She was not surprised at the fact that I had no degree.
Can you give me an example of something that you've written that scares you, or some topic that scares you?
Oh, sure. It's a little scary to write about sexuality. If, for instance, if I write a poem about women having sex with women, readers think, aha, she's a lesbian. Or if I write a poem about men having sex with women. Readers think, well, she's strictly heterosexual. And the truth is that for me, nice, sweet sex is lovely with either one. I've made love with women and I've made love with men. And each person I've ever been with has taught me something valuable, a truth about the world or about myself that I think is valuable enough to be shared in a poem. I have an example. Men and women I have loved before I loved you and why I loved them. I loved Virginia because she was tan and had muscles and could run fast and played with the boys. And Patty, because she wore a red dress with white lace and her hair was black and curled and the little boys tried to kiss her. And Paul, because he lived up the street from me for 10 years. And Neil, because he lived down the street from me for 10 years. And Robert, because he took pictures of drab and homely things. And Leslie, because she smelled like apricots and loved cowboy boots. And Edward, because where he touched me, he left stars instead of bruises and put music where there was pain. I loved Ted because he danced so slowly with me I felt sleepy. And I loved some poet because he was famous, and another poet because he was famous too. I loved my Uncle Al because he looked like Clark Gable and had to have his shoes specially made for him. They were that narrow. And I loved Sharon Stone and her gal Roxy from Basic Instinct because they were hard and sexual and didn't care what anybody thought. I loved Grace and wanted her for her sweet southern speech and her knowing eyes. And I loved a songwriter because his hair was soft as black silk. And he kissed me as if each kiss would be his last. I loved Chrissy Hine because I wanted to be her, and my cousin Terry because he was the only guy under 45 and on my vacation to visit family in Ohio. I loved Dory because she loved me, and I loved Kelson because I was far away and no one would know, except Barbara, whom I also loved. I loved them all in the only way I knew, with my eyes and mouth and the terrible truth of my imperfect body. Later, when I'd had my fill of them, I slept and was led in a dream to you.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
You're a woman over 50, and you're writing about sexuality, your own sexuality.
Yes.
How do people take it from you? Do you think that people react easier because you're an older woman?
Well, I don't know. It's very scary to be a certain woman of a certain age, because this is a society here that hates aging even more than it hates war. But I write about that because I want other women to know that they're not afraid and alone, that we're in it together, and all of us of a certain age, we're all scared. I have a poem about women being scared of aging. It's called 60-something female poet writing to her country in the first decade of a new millennium. Can you please start passion's engine again so we can climb aboard? Can you invite even those with motion sickness? They will come if invited, heads over the side, gaily puking trepidation, happy to be included. Will you let us revisit desire, view it in all its incarnations, as an ache in the skeleton, as contemptuous recognition, as weakness, as madness, as religion, as disease? It still blossoms inside us, regardless of cosmetics' effectiveness. I understand the bias. I see the stuff that lives in people's eyes and throats when they look at me and compare the numbers. Thinking of this, I lie awake, especially on those nights when the moon, a great jaundiced eye, hangs on a silver chain, stirring my chest's heat, stirring its dust. In the mirror, my deranged haircut looks out at me. I am drawn out and back into myself. I accept the image, but not the implication. If I speak persuasively, on behalf of us all, will you crave us? Will you embrace our thin-skinned bodies? Dedicate yourselves to allowing us our beauty? We can still be ignited. We can still burn.
Yeah. Yes, that's wonderful. Let's talk something about networking. Specifically, what about the internet? How much do you think the internet has contributed to your work, to your growth as a poet?
It's been, it really has contributed. It's been a fantastic research tool, for one thing, and a tool for exploring things and places that I would not ordinarily have access to. It's also one of the best things. It's allowed me to read the brilliant work that's being written by poets you never hear about. There are some people writing out there on blogs and on poetry websites who are fantastically creative and they're so talented. And they don't have any books out. They're not widely published. So no one knows who they are. But the internet has opened up this world to a huge extent. And anyone who wants to use it that way can use it that way. You and I met on the internet, and it's been this really exciting experience. I have a friend in the UK whom I would lay down and die for, and I've never even met her in person. And it's exposed me to a vast number of people who are peaceful and prayerful and good, and the vast number of people who are just the opposite. And so I think I'm able to write about the human condition a little more elaborately because I'm exposed through the internet to so much of it.
That's true. In just a cursory glance at the net, you read about a woman being stoned to death in one country. You hear about a volunteer laying down her life for other people in another country. And it's just a flick of the knob. You turn it on and there it is.
Yes, and when you think that there is so much that until the internet, there was so much that the governments kept from people that are now out there that people have access to and have shown by their own videos and their own experiences. It's an incredible way to meet humanity.
I agree.
And be involved in it.
Yeah. Your poem, Bad Manners, is right out there. It's very accusatory, very self-recriminating in terms of Americans, America, and Western culture. Have you ever done bad manners in public?
Yes.
And if so, did the audience react?
Yes.
And how?
I did read it. The reaction, I've read it twice. The reaction both times was very interesting. I finished the poem, and there were a few seconds of silence, and I thought, oh, hell, they hate it. And then there was some applause and some whistles and a few people saying right on, and I was very, very relieved and very glad because it's an important poem to me. And so I was glad to see it received, even if maybe disagreed with, at least received. Would you like me to read it?
I would love you to read it.
Okay. Bad manners. I don't know who to be angry with anymore. That's a lie. I do know. But my rage can't find a release tunnel, something or somewhere to race through. I need to see someone with real power apply a tourniquet to the hemorrhaging of the mortally wounded countries my country has stabbed. It is not enough to see the burning bodies on the news in high definition. You must know that our backyard barbecues mask the smell of smoke across the planet. It is not enough to know that in my country there are mothers in jail for protesting the deaths of their children who were forced to kill other children in other countries, children who were told to kill them. knowing is nothing. Fury is nothing. Oh, sweet America, I don't crave forgiveness for not singing I Love Barney songs with your babies, when I know that the scent of Quinta and the taste of Cubas have been stripped away from the noses and the mouths of those you helped to destroy. I'm not some remorseful woman in a shopping mall, unable to grasp the notion of what belongs to who. We belong to we. The windows through which we watch the world are cleaner than our hands, and the ghosts fleeing by those windows no longer care what languages they speak. Talking of how the water of the rivers in Liberia became beds of gravel, and how the hills of Sarajevo were too gouged and flattened for snow play, a poet said to me, "All you can do is write it again and again until honor turns some of this around." There's a chance he was right, and there's a chance that it's bullshit and can't be turned around. So here is that place in the poem where my rage and futility make me teary and sad and tired. Listen, please. It is not indigestion keeping you awake nights, or the thoughts of a heart you broke in some fit of bad manners or microwave lust. No, this insomnia you suffer is made of oil and blood blending. This insomnia is the total absence of love as humans have known it. This is unabashed knowing climbing into bed with you, putting its hands around your throat, and squeezing until your heart bursts open and its pieces scatter over the world like petals.
Wow. And now the audience says, right on, if they can scrape themselves off the floor.
Yeah, some said right on, and there was this, what seemed like an endless silence, although I know it was a few seconds, but At first I thought, oh dear, I mean, they're just going to hate this. And then I thought, well, if they do, they do. It should, you know, maybe they should hate it. Maybe they should hate every word I said and think about it.
Yeah, I wish. What about movements, political movements? Do you find yourself identifying or connecting to things like feminist movements, hip movements, green movements? How do movements strike you?
I think I connect more to just certain issues than I do movements. Over the last 10 years or so, I've become more passionately worried about the world than I was as a young writer. War and threats of war, poverty and the revolutions that poverty bring. That worries me. Gay rights and the inhuman lack thereof worries me. Oil spills worry me. And so I write of those concerns more often than I used to. I have a poem.
Yeah?
That is dedicated to a man named Saul Landau.
Please.
If you don't know his name, it's S-A-U-L-L-A-N-D-A-U, Saul Landau. Google him. He's an amazing,
yes.
Amazing man and a very good friend of mine. So this was dedicated to him. It's called Until Dark. I see through the open window the trees are trying to avoid the gray sky. To their embarrassment, there's no getting away from it. Those trees are in it until dark, when everything will relax. Until then, they must whisper to each other as conspirators will do from separate phone booths. My friend weeps at night. It is the way he relaxes in the dark, crying over the lost revolutions and the lost soldiers and the lost farmers and the lost families. My friend has declared an allegiance to a humanity that upsets the governments, present and past. He is apt to vomit at hearing too much foolishness. His anger is hypnotic, but he waits for the dark to weep. Who has been dragged off to prison, he wonders. Who has been beaten until dead? How many junkies can dance on the head of a needle? He knows that everything built in the desert soon becomes sand, which is another reason he weeps. Blessed are those who give away kind words. Blessed are those who do not take academia seriously. Blessed are those who know that Hitler and Nixon and Al-Fatah live in the bathrooms of their neighbors' houses, and they still hold back their tears until dark. Cry for the CIA, cry for the prisoners, cry for the DEA and the police, secret and public. Cry for the gang lords and children of the gang lords. Cry for Korea and Vietnam and Iraq and Israel and Palestine and Chile. Cry because Castro is getting old, because buying has replaced learning, because the last drink and the bar's closing is so fucking final. Blessed are you, friend, writing letters to those who have forgotten how to read, pleading for nirvana to find the young and for transcendence to embrace the old. In a dream, I saw you slog through Chiapas to get to Xibalba, then returned and wept. The sky is gray and tired. It recognizes you, understands that whether it offers ink or water, you will swallow the world.
Wow.
I think I also spoke to you that the human lack of rights, gay rights, worries me. And if you like, I have a small poem about that too. Should I read that?
Please.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is called Indigo Children. The term Indigo Children. It's from late night radio, and the term is a paranormal term. It means children who are special in some paranormal way. So that's the name of the poem, Indigo Children. These are my children, mashed mouth babies first, then eyes stern as onyx, mouths turning to chilies, burning to tell a truth they're really not certain of. These are my children. Cigarette smoke falling into vodka blossoms, desire and sarcasm tick-tocking over the appetizers, tenderness, a pulse hiding in their throats. These are my children, impersonating grown-ups, reading lines from reality shows, grinding together on the dance floor, slim, veiled, their damp wings open and closed. Her lover is not as beautiful as my gal Sal. I love the supermodel lesbians, but they don't love me back. Check that ass. A dick to die for. These are my children. Musk and might and misery in a soup of body decided mind. Heelless platform shoes, sleaze-bound. Inimical to the untrendy. Girl, I will have you any way you'll take me. Mister, those abs belong under my hands. Gutter-minded lovers are the best, whether they smell of soap or patchouli. These are my children. Unabashedly horny, uppity bitches, delicious dykes, bi-curious, bi-gorgeous, bye-bye. I want to take you dirty and shower you clean. Cashmere skin, and denim hearts and blistered souls, blessed, caressed, and cursed, seeing the future through the eyes of a dark, dark sky. Smile, scream, laugh, break, mend. Know what they did, don't care, do care. Swollen, flaccid, liberty an empty bed, liberty a lonely bed. Give me liberty or give me a blowjob, queer, bursting, bawling. Could there be any more love anywhere? These are my children. These.
Wow. That's like Mama Earth together with Allen Ginsberg.
Bless you. I'm deeply, I'm deeply saddened by and worried by domestic violence too. And having experienced it, I write about it from time to time. I have had deep feelings about the difficulties of women in society, the constant stresses to be beautiful, to be thin, to stay young. So I've written about those things also.
Do you have something?
Yeah, I do. I have a thing called Song for My Mother that's from after the earthquake. And it's, you know, about those issues. It's called Song for My Mother. Sometimes the fucking shrinks of the world make me sick. It's that knowing everything nod of the head. They write papers on why women are insane. Have you ever once, even once, had a shrink ask you, okay, woman, why are you insane? They don't ask. They don't want to know. They're afraid it might come around to their being it being their fault somehow. They want to tell you why you're insane. I wrote to my shrink. I told him the things in my mind, oh, the things you could think. I said, dear shrink, thank you for the flowering plants. You've sent me green and white Prozac and the sky blue Wellbutrin before that and rosy Paxil and the grain-colored Effexor, too. Thank you for the how are you when we meet and the pleasure in your eyes when I say fine. You suck. You don't know dick about what makes me insane. It isn't just the war, you know. It isn't the flooding in New Orleans. It isn't the starvation in Ethiopia or the spread of AIDS that makes me crazy. It isn't even the fear of death, although I sure as hell am afraid to die. But it's not making me crazy. It's not because I do too much or I don't do enough or because my mother was crazy and her mother too. I can only speak for myself and for all other women, of course. But here it is. I am crazy because my hair is the wrong color again. I am crazy because men don't get a chubby just looking at me. I am crazy because oil of Olay is a lie and L'Oreal is a bigger lie. Refining serum doesn't work, and I can't afford what does work. I am crazy because my bra straps are pulled up so tight I have canyon-sized dents in my shoulders. I am crazy because every mistake I make is a worse one than the last one. I am crazy because I'm not getting any younger, any thinner, any prettier. I'm crazy because I know that Prozac doesn't really work, and I'm crazy because you know it too, dear Doctor Who. Those are not symptoms. No matter what you've been told, no matter what you tell me, those are the issues.
Song for My Mother is a song for so many of us.
Yes.
Yes, yes. And of course, Allen Ginsberg's mother was crazy.
Yes.
Poor darling.
I have a poem, a last poem, that, I don't know, it's sort of, it's like an introduction to who I am and sort of a goodbye to our conversation, kind of. So I'll read that, and we can talk some more if you like. But I'll read that poem. It's called Her Beast Was Gone, and in his place the prince of her dreams lay in her arms. Name nearly anywhere, I've probably not been there. I am native to this place. Born beautiful, a child of the sun, tan year-round, long-legged, casual, blonde, skin like the ripe something or another. My body sports car sleek. I swim like a dolphin goddess, speak enough Spanish slang to get by. Now here's the truth. All that and more somehow escaped my broad Polish grasp. I got my big breasts from Grandma's Hungary, my pale skin from Grandpa's Poland. My looks are Ohio, where they settled, not Palm Springs, where I am. They are dead now. I never cried for them, but I'm faithful to their memory, and I miss them without having known them. This is the Golden West. It must be. I am here in it. there is a continuity of change which makes me no sun child at all, but a princess praying to be beautiful or free or good.
I see. You are your prince. You are your prince. Well, I think most of this interview has been me smiling, which doesn't translate very well on the radio.
Well, yeah, I was told once by a poet friend that I smile promiscuously. So I do, I guess.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm a promiscuous smiler and a promiscuous laugher.
Well, it's contagious.
I'm glad it is.
Well, thank you very
much. It's good to see your
much.
Smile. You have a beautiful smile.
And I don't know. I feel we can take this conversation to all kinds of specific areas. You are listening to Spirit World Restless with DJ Judy on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at yahi.net, port 9000. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at http://spfradio.yahi.net for playlists, schedules, archives, and more. This episode is devoted to a conversation with the poet Martina Newbery. Now, the second part of our chat. Enjoy.
So much last time. I really wanted to speak again with you. So,
oh, nice. Okay.
Are you ready to delve into your psyche and heart?
Of course. Absolutely. I'm not sure what we'll find there, but go ahead.
Okay, let's go for it. As long as we're willing.
We'll okay. Close. That's right. Okay. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Now, in your poem that you read for us last time, Bad Manners, you said, a poet said to me, all you can do is write it again and again until honor turns some of this around. This line very much intrigued me, and I was wondering, who was this poet who said this to you?
It was Jalil Marbrook, who is a favorite of mine. I was very down. I was very down about writing. It didn't seem to matter. My work didn't matter, the work of other poets didn't seem to matter. And I suggested to Jalil in an email that war and starvation and the enslavement of the world had taken all the enthusiasm over the entire planet and took all the attention off of the things that were going on, and was no longer interested in what poets had to say or what the international community of writers had to say about how wrong those things were. And it was making me feel really, really down. And he wrote me this beautiful note about why we write, about the reasons that we write. And one of the things that he wrote was, all you can do is write it again and again until honor turns some of this around. And I liked it so much that I put it in a page in my journal so that every time I opened the journal to begin writing, I would see that and realize that things do matter and that all you can do is just keep writing until honor turns some of it around.
I'd like to ask you,
yes,
who do you consider your heroes, your heroines, people of honor, people who inspire you?
Well, to begin with, you're absolutely an honorable person. I can see that by your work and by knowing you.
Thank you very much.
True. More attention needs to be paid to them, but they are there. Very close to home. My husband is an honorable man. My father-in-law and his wife are honorable. Further away, on the horizon, the Dalai Lama seems an honorable man. Rabbi David J. Foreman from the Rabbis for Human Rights, he seems to be a person of honor. Shira Nabatin, who won the 2003 Nobel Peace Prize for her work working on women's rights in Iran. She seems a person of honor to me. There's a poet, Ilya Kaminsky, who founded Poets for Peace, who seems an honorable person. Sharon Olds, C.K. Williams are poets who belong to that. And, of course, my dear friend and mentor, Larry Kramer, was an honorable man.
Yes, I understood that from what you've been saying. And about Larry Kramer, you said that he was a master of techniques which helped you and other poets open up your boundaries to catch a view from a new perspective. Could you share perhaps one or two of his techniques with us?
Absolutely. I still have all my old, anciently old notebooks from when we first met, and I kept notes about what he said. One of the things he said was, don't ever shy away from the bizarre.
What does that mean?
That means don't ever think that anything is too strange to think about or to postulate on. Don't get scared away by something that appears bizarre. Another one is make outlandish statements. Those of us who write, poetic license is the rule of the game, and we get to make outlandish statements and paint things with a broad brush if we want to. And that's part of the nature and fun of being an artist of any kind, really. And I think one of the most valuable things that he taught me and others was that if a poem is about something real, change it around so that the fictive possibilities appear. And that's a really wonderful technique. Make something fictive in there with what's real to you about what you're writing. Exploring the fictive possibilities of a subject makes the poem broader. And I think we've all read poems or stories that were so personal that we almost felt left out at reading them. It's almost like the reader doesn't have a place in it. And
yes.
And so if you explore the fictive possibilities, you give the reader a place in there. So
By broadening
yeah.
the subject, by loosening it up, you
yes.
give a place for,
yeah.
for the listener to include themselves, you're saying?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Like my refrigerator that I'm working with. I should expand her horizons, perhaps.
Well, the exercise, I can see that you're doing that, with just what you said about writing about
yeah.
the refrigerator.
Yeah.
It tends to lend itself to after you write about the refrigerator itself, it kind of becomes something else. There's a truth in there about other things.
Yes.
So.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's wonderful. I love it. It's the bizarre section. As soon as you feel you're into the bizarre area, go with it. Make the statement.
Exactly.
Don't
exactly.
be shy. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Now, could you possibly read something that Larry wrote? I don't have his book, Brilliant Windows. I would love to hear something.
Absolutely, I would love to.
Okay.
I'm going to read something called The Fetus, and it's what we were just talking about. It's a poem about something real that explores the fictive.
Okay.
And
okay,
I'll read that.
Excellent.
In Missouri, where we had escaped Texas, we lived by the university. I roamed canyons of books, toured the hall of minerals, crystals in their black lights, wonderful as wounds of the living Christ. One as violently fearsome as a dinosaur jaw. In a basement, the fetus was my particular friend. A blanched fist, a tuber, a figure like a Buddha carved by an Eskimo, and speaking if only less than a whisper from its clouding solution. Be nothing, it said. No one, of a dark shelf, ignored but by your own. Dissolve, a poet, slowly into this strange form, glow, but ever more distant, the ice and grit of a comet.
that's amazing.
And yeah, he was an amazing writer, and right there, it's what we were just talking about. You know, you're talking about something that's very real and giving it a broader horizon.
Yes, yes. Okay. What about your other heroes, your other heroines? Could you just name a few and in a sentence or two, tell me what they mean to you, how they inspire you?
Sure. Robert Frost is one of my writing heroes because of the way he captures complex feelings with very simple language. He writes about loneliness, which is a simple, you know, idea, but he writes about it in such a way that you really feel it. I'm afraid Robert Frost was known for being very mean, so that's probably why he knew what loneliness was. He wrote this wonderful poem. One of my favorite poems of his is called The Hill Wife.
Yes.
And I'll just to exemplify what I'm talking about, simple language, I'll read part of it.
Okay.
This is part 5 of the poem, The Hill Wife, and it's called The Impulse. It was too lonely for her there, and too wild. And since there were but two of them, and no child, and work was little in the house, she was free, and followed where he furrowed field or felled tree. She rested on a log and tossed the fresh chips with only a song to herself on her lips. And once she went to break a bough of black alder. She strayed so far she scarcely heard when he called her and didn't answer, didn't speak or return. She stood and then she ran and hid in the fern. He never found her, though he looked everywhere, and he asked at her mother's house, was she there? Sudden and swift and light as that, the ties gave, and he learned of finalities beyond the grave.
Wow, so sad.
This poem leaves me with, yeah, and it's just the simple words, they leave me with that feeling of loneliness. So,
a huge gash in the heart. And
another poet of mine, oh yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Another poet I like very much is an American poet named Amy Lowell. I don't know if you know her. She died in 1925, fairly contemporary. And she's one of my favorites. Her strength is very inspiring, and her way of getting to the heart of things, just grabbing you right away and pulling you into the heart of things, is just amazing. She does that in a poem called...
So do you have an example?
I do.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay. But I do love her work. She does that in her... She has a poem called Patterns. And it's both an anti-war poem and a love poem.
Uh-huh.
And I won't read it all. It's very long. But if you aren't familiar with her work, look some of it up. She's fabulous.
Okay.
I've skipped great parts of this, but this will give you an idea of what I'm talking about and the strength of the words. She says, I walk down the patterned garden paths in my stiff brocaded gown with my powdered hair and jeweled fan. I, too, am a rare pattern as I wander down the garden paths. Not a softness anywhere about me, only whalebone and brocade, and I sink on a seat in the shade of a lime tree, for my passion wars against the stiff brocade. In my bosom is a letter I have hid. It was brought to me this morning by a rider from the Duke. Madam, we regret to inform you that Lord Hartwell died in action Thursday night. I stood upright, held rigid to the pattern by the stiffness of my gown. Up and down I walked, up and down. In a month, he would have been my husband. In a month, here underneath this lime, we would have broke the pattern, he for me, and I for him. He as colonel, I as lady, on this shady seat. He had a whim, the sunlight created blessings. And I answered, it shall be as you have said. Now he is dead. In summer and winter, I shall walk up and down the patterned garden paths in my stiff brocaded gown. I shall go up and down in my gown, gorgeously arrayed, boned and stayed, and the softness of my body will be guarded from embrace by each button, hook, and lace. For the man who should loose me is dead, fighting with the Duke in Flanders in a pattern called war. Christ, what are patterns for?
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's an amazing poem.
Okay. Okay, so jumping from the laced-up bodice, let's talk about something that we do to free ourselves, experimenting in poetry.
Okay.
When I think of experimenting, I think of first opening my mind and then seeing what comes out of me. And to do this, I might use music or art, and it puts me in a totally different frame of mind. I might also use other things, which I won't mention now. How about you? How do you rid yourself? How do you rid yourself to be experimental?
Photographs is one way. That seems to bring up, looking at photographs seems to bring up all sorts of ideas for me. I love books of photos, and not just the art photos, but photos of people I don't know, or old Victorian photos. I've just become really fascinated with these old Victorian mourning photos, in which the dead are posed as if they're just sleeping.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Or the photographers clamp the deceased. They clamp them in a standing position so that they look fully awake, and either by some mechanism to hold their eyes open, or they painted pupils on their eyes, and looking at those always gives me very unusual ideas. they're fascinating. Anyway, another thing I do is I'll read something that I find unusual. There's a writer, Philip K. Dick is his name.
Yes.
And his books make me very restless and feeling like creating something different, going someplace else. So that's what I do.
I see. That's very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. I also find that if I'm lacking any kind of input, I'll just listen to Allen Ginsberg either sing or recite one of his poems.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite is Sunflower Sutra.
Absolutely.
Do you know it?
I love Sunflower Sutra. Oh, yes, I do know it. I love it.
I love it.
And I love it. I love the recordings of him doing it with the little finger symbols.
Yes, it's beautiful.
I love that. Yeah. It really is. Yeah.
When you listen to someone so passionate, you can't help but just, you know, take something from it. So I'm going to ask...
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You're in the middle of a sentence. Please, do it.
No, I was just going to say... excuse me. I was just going to say that Ginsberg was not, he wasn't just a poet, he was the poem.
Oh, yes.
You know, his life and what he stood for and everything, he was so much himself and a poem in his own. I mean, he was just this walking, breathing poem.
He was passionate about everything.
Yeah, I like him too.
He was passionate about everything.
Absolutely.
He led everybody after him. And he wasn't ashamed of a thing. He was, brilliant.
You have been listening to Spirit World Restless with DJ Judy on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at yahi.net, port 9000. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at http://spfradio.yahi.net for playlists, schedules, archives, and more. I would like to thank Martina Newbery for being the guest on this inaugural episode of my show. We conclude now with Martina reading a six-pack of her poems from her latest book, Late Night Radio. Thank you for listening. Shalom, Om Mani Padme Hum. Bye.
I'm very pleased to be here reading with you tonight. I'm going to read 6 poems. The first is What Madness Is. What Madness Is. Madness is anger's placenta, a thorny cord that strangles, a finger that writes no more in death's fluids. Madness is this confession. I have encountered my enemy. I wanted to set fire to my enemy. I wanted to perform unnatural acts on my enemy. Madness is a dream in the morning of transitory waters, and the ruby blood of I love you moving between the tired legs of a tired woman. Madness is that white mania that leaps from stony heart to stony heart, turns the universal mysteries into fishhooks and phantasms. Straight out of the Black Sea comes the madness of Amen, the madness of allure, of sex that cripples your senses, it is that vigorous. Madness is the tight knot of wisdom and hatred, and later ecstasy of a kind known only to the saints. Anarchic and unassuming, madness brings a coward's blades to the throats of the world's inquisitors. Madness is no vindication, no escape plan. Only these words, clenching inside you like fists, like teeth, like closed eyes. This is called Palette. The silences of moments don't support me like they used to. Heartbeats, like the ding-dong of bells, pass through me and don't stay. It's embarrassing, the way living in a near-deserted town embarrasses the few who stay on. Love threatens me. Faith comes at me like a grimy rag, wants to scour my face. My clasped hands render clear blood, but not a clear mind. And the surrounding desert song is monotonous, even when the coyotes kick in. Desert sand keeps nothing out, holds nothing in. My gestures look tranquil, feel frantic. I've tossed my reflection into noon's white heat, which clings like silica spider webs, adjusts hue without color. At night, I lay awake, my body dirtied by unrecountable dreams. When it's dawn, something reclaims me, and I move toward the excesses of light. This is called 1,000 Signs. I have been naked in soul and body with women whose names escape me. I have shared my body's portfolio with men whose hearts were too heated to resonate anything but divine urgency. It makes me wonder, is love a sick bed? Can we love ourselves only if we see our lust for others as disease? I am drawn to an impossible point of light, a sign outside my national language. I am free to read it. I am free to view the wreckage of 1,000 signs in 1,000 places. I have seen the light. Men who love men are splotches of sunlight in the shadows that cross the deck. Women who love women are rivers of questions on a desert planet. The rest of us tremble, intend to be happy. Take love back from the bold ones who have sheltered it. In the end, we are all caught, made to walk the gangplank. In the end, every night is All Hallows' Eve. The gilded sky covers all of us, and, regardless of choices, we all take it hard when we die. This poem is called Your Poems on My Patio. And the poem is dedicated to one of my favorite poets, Jalua Marbrook. Your poems on my patio, for Jalua. The mountains are perfect this morning, so I reread your perfect poems. Knit 2, purl 3, knit 2, purl 2. And there on the page is a scarf in hearty woolen adverbs and adjectives. I would do nearly anything to know that someone lingered over my images as I do yours, and I would do it twice to find you'd borrowed one of my phrases. You must know that your poems, so beautiful they are treacherous, paralyze my pen. Oh, I realize this isn't an appropriate way to show gratitude, nor is it an answer to my reflection in the cracked mirror of my own regrets. This morning, my friend, I found autumn and the sea and terror and love and wonder and pain and such enviable nourishment that I can never forgive you. Yes, I am tired, and even the surreal sky, even the spirit-filled mountains don't rouse me to action. I read instead. Read your poems and sip at a mimosa, because it's never too early for champagne. This is called Stone Steps. I don't want to go to people's parties anymore. We have rented a second floor apartment with stone steps and a stone balcony looking over the courtyard. I don't want to disturb the hummingbirds at our feeder by opening the door to go out for how do you do's and I'd love another drink. We have rented this apartment, you see, and I want to wander around it silently, thinking of poems, finding misplaced items. 2 weeks ago, the blind man on the first floor died. His name was Albert. He went out every day for a walk around the swimming pool, and look what it got him. He's dead. I don't think I like people's parties anymore. They make me feel like a too large child, pretending to know the right things to say or do. I want to wander the catacombs of my head, learn calligraphy, French, history of the paintings of the Dutch masters. I don't want to remember how it was. I want only to see what might be. My heart is breaking at people's parties. Sexual desire whistles the same tunes as sexual decay when the conversations turn to love. And after all, what is there left to talk about after the politics of war, the ethical poses of religions, the egregiously bad behavior of the new movie legends? I'm quite satisfied thinking of your ankles touching mine beneath our sheets. I'm happy seeing the wind harass the palm trees. I like the taste of chocolates, potato chips, and ice cream more than the taste of wine or gin. The days are becoming thick with indifference. How can I live like this? The other side of panic. It begins with the desert's hot sky, mendacious as always, alchemizing grief and loathing into love stories. Here is the other side of panic, a dug-in deep lethargy that makes your marrow itch. Anyway, the desert underwrites your soul's story. You become untethered from yourself, which may or may not be a good thing. Such intricacy. People in the sand looking for closure as if there was such an animal. We'll do this so we can have closure, they say, when what they mean is they want every gory detail. They want to smell and taste the who, what, where, when, why in each sanctification of violence. I dream a lot in this desert. My dreams turned to fish line, which I use to sew what is real to what is not.